Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School Policy Cast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and in this, the third and last of our three faculty roundtables in the lead up to Donald Trump's inauguration, we're talking about the new president's approach to leadership. Joining us is senior lecturer David King, who directed the Task Force on Election Administration for the National Commission on Election Reform in the early 2000s, and now chairs the Kennedy School's Masters of Public Administration program. Lecturer Barbara Kellerman is the founding executive director of the school's Center for Public Leadership and author of the recent book, Hard Times, Leadership in America. Professor Roger Porter served more than a decade in senior economic policy positions in the White House, most recently in the George H.W. Bush administration. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
As we enter this new age with President Trump, I think there's a lot of open questions as to what direction the country is going to go in and how someone who, I think this is the first president who has had no experience in either government or military service in history, how he's going to take charge of the country. Professor Porter, you've served in the White House. If you were there right now, what would you be advising President-elect Trump on how he could proceed?
I've had the opportunity of being involved in five presidential transitions, three coming in and two going out. And the short answer is transitioning in is a lot more fun than transitioning out. I'm very impressed with what has happened in the way in which we handle presidential transitions today in comparison with a few decades ago. Administrations now go out of their way to make the life of the incoming administration easy rather than difficult. And I was very impressed with the comments made by President Obama in, even though he was disappointed in the results of the election, in pledging his cooperation and the cooperation of his administration in making it easy for the people coming in. I am informed that he has continued to have several conversations with President-elect Trump so that when he comes in, he can hit the ground running, as the proverbial phrase goes. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, even if you have a group of people who wish you not ill, but wish you well, transitions are very difficult and often chaotic because you're trying to get ready to do something that you haven't done before. And in this case, this is one of the few times when we have elected a president who has no governmental experience whatsoever, federal, state, or local. He's a very capable individual. It takes a lot to win a presidential election. But what he's about to do now, he cannot do on his own. The defining characteristic of our American political system is that we divide and distribute and fragment power. And how he develops his relationship with the other branches of government and with his own executive branch is going to be a big task for him.
Barbara Kellerman, you've recently written a book, Hard Times, about leadership in the United States. I'm curious about how you think this new administration is different from previous administrations. Has President Trump harnessed something that is new, or is this just a repeat of what we've seen happen over and over?
Well, in terms of differences, let me count the ways. I can only say there are so many ways, and even in this brief conversation, we've already alluded to some of them. I think, though, rather than emphasizing the idiosyncrasy of Donald Trump, which is so self-evident, I think I'll choose this moment to point to the American people, who are the so-called followers, or particularly the electorate, although God knows a very large percentage of people did not vote at all. In general, American voters are restless in a way and impatient in a way and crude and rude in a way that is historically unprecedented. This is amplified by technology, obviously social media in particular. So no matter how gifted a leader Donald Trump may turn out to be, the loudness and brashness and even coarseness of the voices that he will have to be dealing with during, let's assume for the moment, the at least 4 years, is historically unprecedented. And it doesn't stop. You know, the sort of 24/7 drumbeat of discontent, malcontent, frustration is, again, really a new and different environment, not just for this particular leader, but for anybody who's trying to lead anything in American politics. The last thing I'll say at this moment is this is not singular to the United States. The level of voter discontent, of constituent discontent, we see it all over, particularly Western Europe. And I would even argue that some of the repressiveness that we've seen in some countries in recent months and years is in direct response to their knowledge that unless they became more oppressive than they've been in the past, they are likely to deal with an awful lot of constituent unrest.
David King, a lot of Donald Trump's putative success in business has come as a CEO. As a CEO, you obviously have a lot of power over what happens in your organization. The president is not nearly as empowered because of the checks and balances in our system. Although he does walk into office with a Republican Senate, a Republican House of Representatives, is he going to have to adjust the way he approaches how he works, or is the rest of the government going to have to adjust to him?
Well, he doesn't have to adjust anything, right? If he wants to be successful, the answer is, of course, he has to adjust. I liked Roger's phrase when he said that we have to remember that this system of government is one where we have divided and distributed and fragmented power. It was designed that way. It's also tremendously divisive historically. I guess I disagree with Barbara. I think we have had precedents that look like this, certainly the late 1800s, all the way through the mid-1920s in terms of how folks were getting along in Congress and what they were saying about each other and repressive movements. This is not new. We survived. I think we are going to survive this one as well. But yes, to be successful, one has to work with the powers that be, and the power that be is not in the White House. The powers that be exist in the state houses and certainly in Congress. And yes, it's a united government right now with a very strong majority in the House, a very important and strong majority in the Senate. But there are lots of procedural blocks. So the Senate, where he has a 1-2 seat majority, which you ought to be able to work with, the filibuster is going to be in place, and that means that the Democrats can stop a lot of important legislation. On the House side, you know, there's this important rift that has been there since with Speaker Ryan and President Trump, and I anticipate that Speaker Ryan will become a bit more of sort of a statesman and leader. I'm not quite a prime minister in the United States, but he will be riding that majority in important ways. And so if President Trump is to be, quote unquote, successful, it has to be in cooperation with others.
If you take the period since Franklin Roosevelt, Donald Trump will be the 7th Republican president. And there were 7 Democratic presidents. We've sort of alternated between the political parties. All 7 Democratic presidents came into office with Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate. Of the 7 Republican presidents, only 3 of them, Dwight Eisenhower, George W. Bush, and now Donald Trump, will come in with majorities. Those majorities are often pretty slender. David rightly points out that he's got a more comfortable majority in the House, although the House has got a group of Tea Party Republicans that are often a challenge for any speaker to lead. But in the Senate, with 51 or 52, depending, probably 52 Republican and 48 Democrat, the capacity to get things done is
greatly diminished by the fact that effectively you have to get 60 votes on most things. Republicans have been talking about doing a variety of things through what's called reconciliation. This was a device originally developed in the Carter administration, extensively used by David Stockman in the Reagan administration, and every administration has from time to time found good use for it. It's the only way you got the Affordable Care Act passed.
That's right.
Was using it through reconciliation. So both parties have engaged in it, and what they discover is that in the short term, it can benefit you. Mm-hmm. But over the longer term, you build up both resentment and opposition that often make it more difficult for you to do things. When you win, there's this exhilaration and a set of expectations. People are expecting us to do things, so we're going to go charging off. And then you discover what we all discover in our own lives. Things take longer than we think they're going to. They are harder than we think they're going to be. There are things we haven't foreseen that we have to overcome. And we discover in the end that it's really useful to have some friends. It's really useful to have some people who are willing to work with us. And to the extent that you create an environment which welcomes and encourages people to work with you, which is almost always the case at the beginning. No one wants to stand up at the beginning and say, hold it, I wish you ill, and I hope you fall flat on your face, because every president elect makes the kind of speech that Donald Trump made. I consider myself the president of all the people. I'm going to look out for the interests of all Americans. I want to work with the outgoing administration, and I want to work with the Congress, the Senate. Everybody says that. Happily, it's good. I'd much rather have a system in which people are polite with one another. But when the rubber hits the road, and when you get into talking about the specifics of policy, you discover that we are a nation that's roughly 50-50. And people do have different policy preferences, and they do have different priorities. That's one of the wonderful things about democracy. Democracy takes the preferences and priorities of all sorts of people and tries to meld them together. Donald Trump's success is going to rest in part on how well he works with others rather than the extent to which he is able to dominate others. And the quicker he learns that lesson, the better off he will be.
I think one of the defining aspects of candidate Trump was that he was slightly hard to pin down on any particular issue. I heard it said, some people are misinterpreting him because they're listening to what he's saying literally instead of more figuratively, where, his supporters are hearing his frustration rather than the specific policies. Now that he's actually president, now that he has to actually make changes, is he going to lose some grasp of that power that he had before?
Well, it's a question of what do you exactly mean by power? The power that he exercised during the campaign was a very different, in fact, as Roger just suggested, a very different kind of power from the one that he's going to have to exercise when he is actually president. As we know, campaigning for the White House is one thing, and actually governing from the White House is something quite different. It's interesting about the degree, when I said earlier, although David disagreed, I would argue that Trump was a singular candidate, that we've never seen a candidate quite like that in terms of his willingness to say things that made people completely crazy.
I don't know. Warren G. Harding was quite out there.
Well, he was quite out there, but I'm not sure. Partly it's the changing culture. In other words, the culture has changed in ways that tolerate a level of outrage that I think, again, in terms of groups, individuals, sexual innuendo, you name it, we've experienced it in the last year and a half. What I was going to say was it's not clear how well Trump is. He's so used to being a dominant personality. To the degree that the emphasis is actually, he keeps talking about the art of the deal. Well, we'll see whether that art of the deal is achieved through the capacity to negotiate, or dare I say, to play well with others. His experience, from what we can tell, his strong suit is not playing well with others. On the other hand, he is succeeding someone. We haven't mentioned Obama, but I think it's worth putting Trump in at least a brief historical context. By wide agreement, Obama's skill was absolutely not in working particularly well with Congress. He did not use, and I think Trump will use, the perks of the White House. And by the way, dare I say, Melania has a role. I'm sorry to sound perhaps old-fashioned here, but this is a couple that's eventually presumably going to be in the White House. And to the degree that you can use the perks of the presidential office to cajole others to go along with you, and by others, I mean other Washington players, including members of Congress, that goes a long way. And the Obamas, neither one of them was particularly good at doing that. So it is entirely possible that the man that I would describe as a bull in a china shop, literally and figuratively, we can talk about China later maybe, may turn out to be more adroit than he would originally have been given credit for.
Matt, I'm grateful that you introduced Warren G. Harding into our discussion and reminded that Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of the Treasury and his son-in-law, William McAdoo, once described Warren G. Harding's speeches as an army of pompous phrases marching across the landscape in search of an idea. He said occasionally they would actually capture a straggling thought and bear it a prisoner in their midst until it died of servitude and overwork. So the hyperbolic rhetoric.
Very nice, Roger. Very
the hyperbolic
nice.
Rhetoric that very Barbara nice. Reminds us of has been around for quite a while. Let me just say one thing about Donald Trump, and I do not know him. I've had the privilege of knowing and working with every Republican and Democrat who has run for president since 1976.
Well, he's both, so we're in good shape.
Except for him. But I have spoken with people who have known him for a long period of time and who have worked with him in one capacity or another in New York. And what they tell me is that there is one thing that matters most to him, and that is what he calls winning. And he wants to be a winner. And my guess is that he will try very hard to figure out a way to win as he calculates winning. Now, how presidents calculate winning is in many ways. He seems to be quite interested in polls and in what other people think. And so my suspicion is he will take a number of measures which he will have some confidence will be popular with the public. He's also going to discover that if he wants to win with Congress, meaning is going to want to get legislation passed, that he's going to need to be flexible in what it is that he proposes and what it is that he ultimately accepts. If there is any truism that applies to the American political system, it is that policy is always the product of many hands. And he's going to discover that whether it's officials within his own administration who are not going to agree with one another all the time, or with the Congress, or with governors and other important officials he has to deal with, there's going to be a lot of give and take. How successfully he does that, and in particular how successfully he does it at the outset, it's quite interesting how patterns get established. Perceptions are created and images get emblazoned on people, and they're very hard to change. Trust is something that is earned over an extended period of time, and it can be lost or damaged. And so my advice would be for him to be very careful in the first moves that he makes and keep in mind that he's going to want to have those be moves that will assist him the next day and the next week and the next month and the next year to think about the long term. And many presidents, when they come into office full of the excitement of an election victory and with a majority of their own party, discover that the tables can turn and turn rather quickly.
I want to pick up on something else that we've talked about, and that is, it wasn't clear what he actually ran on in terms of specifics, right? And that is certainly unconventional in these days, where people are trying to pin them down on the following 27 points and so forth. But there used to be this literature in political science called the importance of strategic ambiguity, which is basically, hey, I'll tell one set of people one thing, another set of people another thing. You want to be clear, but strategically ambiguous.
What Hillary Clinton told Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And now Goldman
not
Sachs.
Not to her credit, I might add. That was not a winning right. thing to say out loud.
Well, works for Goldman Sachs if they now have the Treasury Secretary. So we do see in his document about the first 100 days what he's going to do. There's at least a passable list there. And I found it interesting how much wasn't on that list. He still is strategically ambiguous about a lot of things. I think that's to his benefit, absolutely. If he wants to win, there might be some interesting low-hanging fruit. We had Fidel Castro recently die, and President-elect Trump has gone on the record many times saying he's going to get rid of that terrible executive order, which was beginning the process of normalizing relations under President Obama. But I was fascinated by a tweet that President-elect Trump had last week, in which he managed to again be so brilliantly strategically ambiguous. He said, "We're going to get rid of that executive order because I can negotiate a better one." Now that's playing it both ways. I have no idea what he's going to do, but I think he's at least on the right track and not taking a hard line on one side or the other yet. So some of the unexpectedly
interesting
things.
Wouldn't you consider a low-hanging fruit infrastructure? Isn't that the one area that we keep hearing over and over again? Supposedly there's room for agreement among both Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. It is about money. I get that, but surely something can be done. Apropos the point about an early success, would that be in an area?
Well, sure. But what's interesting now is, at least to the conversations on Capitol Hills, what do we mean by infrastructure? Since we know the infrastructure thing is going to work, right? Well, infrastructure suddenly has to include the internet, rapid transit. It's not simply building some good bridges again. There could be exciting things that we haven't really talked about. You know, what happens if he pushes for D.C. statehood or D.C.? That would be very unexpected and would move his support in an interesting new direction. Or what if he comes out supporting more autonomy for Puerto Rico? What happens there? So, he is so unpredictable that it's going to be very interesting to watch. And I absolutely agree, Roger, this guy wants to win. And he wants to be popular.
So do you think statehood for Puerto Rico is going to do it? It does not strike me as a hot political issue, I have to say. What can I tell you?
One of the things I find
fascinating about this last year is that very few Americans realize that during 2016, a Republican Congress and a Democratic president passed Trade Promotion Authority, passed a Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, passed the African Growth and Development Act, passed a $305 billion highway surface transportation bill. Speaking of infrastructure.
That's right.
Made permanent the research and experimentation tax credit, which we've been talking about doing for the last 30 years. Made permanent the Section 179 provisions that apply to small businesses, did the so-called doc fix with Medicare, which has been around for decades, and everybody keeps extending it, but no one has been able to make it permanent, and made that permanent. The list goes on. I wager that very few Americans are aware of any of those things, in part because they didn't draw a lot of national attention, and the president didn't go out of his way to trumpet these as successes.
You can't use the word trumpet anymore. That's not going to work, Roger.
Well, but, was that strategic? Because, maybe trumpeting him might have been a bad thing for Republicans?
No. Let's remind ourselves. People who are in elective office, whether they're in the executive branch or in the legislative branch, want to do things. people don't go through the ordeal of getting elected, which is a real ordeal in the American political system, simply to go there and complain and grouse about others. They end up doing some of that, to be sure, but they want to do things. And so Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, when they came in, said, we want to have a functioning Congress, and worked with the administration on a whole series of issues. I could multiply the list that I just gave twofold, and found some common ground. Donald Trump will be wise if he finds some common ground with Republicans and Democrats in both the House and Senate, because what he will discover is that putting things in place that, for example, Obamacare is going to be much easier to overturn, the parts of it that you can do through reconciliation. If they had gone for a bipartisan majority, which they could have, and done it like Medicare and Medicaid and the Clean Air Act and Americans Disabilities Act, and you get large bipartisan support, no one has ever talked about repealing those. But if you do it in a way that gets the hair on people's necks to stand up and feel like they have been excluded and ignored and disregarded, when they get the opportunity, as they eventually will, they will try to undo it. And what he should want to do is to try to figure out how he can get a broad base of support, whether it's corporate tax reform or coming up with what we're going to replace the health care system with, or legal immigration or infrastructure, any number of things. We're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with the global trading system.
I think it'd
as
be
well.
Interesting to have a little brief discussion about his cabinet appointees so far as we're sitting here, and whether we think that they are conducive to the kind of collective collaboration that has been mentioned. I don't know what the two of you think about that, but he seems so far to have sort of gone very conservative, somewhat conservative, possibly slightly less conservative, and very much...
You mean the big Democratic fundraisers?
Well, I'm talking about many Democrats. I'm talking about class very much. This is not exactly a populist crowd here. Is anybody going to notice? Is anybody going to care? I mean, we have a very particular roster of cabinet appointees so far, and the media is going. I'm just saying, it seems to be in violation of, you know, what is the line about dredging the swamp? That doesn't seem to be so far. The roster of people seems to be extremely establishment, extremely wealthy. Very few exceptions to that general rule.
Just a second. When you say very establishment. And I don't know about people's individual wealth. Some of them have a lot. But let's look at the people whom he's thinking of bringing in. They are not part of what would be called the Washington establishment. Very few of them have ever served in the executive branch of government. He's got a chief of staff. He's got a chief strategist. He's got a national security advisor. He's got a director of the CIA. None of these people have ever worked in the executive branch.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, he is banking, I think, on having some people who are going to take a fresh look at things that are not part of what he calls the swamp, mm-hmm. which I think, I don't know, I'm not inside his mind, but I think by when he says draining the swamp, he means not doing things in the way that we have traditionally done them. Not thinking in the ways that we traditionally think about things. So I want to have a fresh look. I suspect that he and some others may be surprised to discover that when you start looking at any policy, that's what I discovered during the 11 years that I was there, that there are lots of things that you learn in the process of looking at a policy and discovering
why something is the way it is. When we ever had a policy issue, I demanded that we go back and look at what each of the last six previous administrations had done on the issue to try to figure out how did we get to where we are now. It wasn't a mistake. It's not just the product of happenstance. What is it that produced the policy that we have now? What are the interests that are in support of that, and why? Because if we're going to change it for something better, we're going to have to figure out what are the interests that we're going to have to overcome. And I think he is gambling, as far as I can tell, he is gambling on the notion that I'm going to have some fresh eyes coming in here looking at how to do things differently. He will discover that there are lots of reasons why things are being done the way they are, and it doesn't mean that things can't change, because they always do. We've got a very different government today than we had 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But it does mean that we're going to have some fresh eyes looking at
it,
the world.
It's shades of John F. Kennedy appointing Robert McNamara as defense secretary he was, of course, CEO of Ford, coming in as defense secretary. Whether that was an effective pick is up for discussion.
That's very much open to debate.
You mentioned a tweet of Donald Trump's. Of course, one of the perks of the office of president is, Teddy Roosevelt's bully pulpit. New York Times in November had a story. I think the headline was something to the effect of, "Is every Trump tweet worth covering?" And Donald Trump has certainly been able to, master that form. Perhaps it's perhaps the best mastering of a new technology by at least an incoming president since the fireside chats by Franklin Roosevelt. Is he going to be able to really leverage that?
I don't think as president he'll be able to tweet in the same way he has as candidate or president-elect, because the presidential statements carry a tremendous amount of policy weight. They usually are interpreted as almost policy statements, so he can't be thinking out loud. Now, at the end of the campaign, his staff did take away his phone and didn't let him tweet anymore. And there's an interesting analysis that's been done on sort of whether the tweets came off on an Android device or an iPhone device. He actually uses an Android device, and the Android device tweets are far more bombastic and uncautious, and the iPhone device tweets are much more measured. When he becomes president, I don't think he's going to be tweeting with the same kind of wild abandon. I don't think that what he's doing is irrational. I think the way he's been tweeting up a storm lately is much like a magician captures your attention while he's stealing your watch. Look over here while we're doing something. So it's been a tremendously successful way of cutting out the media. But as president, he'll find other ways to communicate. And a lot of what the president does is not communicate. So what the president doesn't say can say an awful lot. So I think we're not going to be talking about Twitter as much 6 months from now.
I think one indication of the tweets is the series of tweets about Hamilton, when Pence went to Hamilton and the audience booed, and then the cast lectured him on... lectured Pence on what they would like to have see happen. And in his indignation, Trump tweeted several times. What was happening simultaneously to that particular tweet was the legal decision to settle the suit against Trump University. So instead of the media paying a lot of attention to what was going on with Trump University, the tweets were serving to deflect. So he has used them brilliantly and strategically.
Mm-hmm. I like to remind students that more is not better. Better is better. And that applies not only to us in our individual lives, it applies in spades to presidents. The more careful, cautious, strategic, and limited presidents are in what they choose to say,
the more people pay attention to them, the more people believe what they have to say, the more power they are actually able to exercise. This is a lesson which most people have to learn experientially. It would be nice if they could learn it vicariously, but most people, many of us learned all sorts of lessons in our lives experientially.
Well, Donald Trump has certainly, his experience over this mm-hmm. election has been the more the better almost. Although you brought up the staff taking away his phone, that just happened to be when his surge towards the end of the election happened. Do you think it's possible that he might have taken away, a positive lesson from that, and he will put down the phone?
Yeah, that's what I'm expecting. Sure.
Yeah.
You're still waiting, though, David. It hasn't happened. You know, I we keep thinking that Trump is going to conform to our conceptions of what has been in the past, and he has done that very, very little. Mm-hmm. He seems to enjoy breaking the mold, and I am not so sure that he's not going to tweet from the Oval Office. I could be wrong. And the more is more that Roger just mentioned, I mean, I can think of a lot of presidents, as was suggested, who would have benefited from that. By the way, Barack Obama spoke an awful lot and would have benefited, I think, from speaking a little bit less. It depends, though, on how they speak. So, for example, I don't think we've had a press conference yet since the election from Donald Trump, although he's announcing one on December 15th. I realize this will be aired in January, where he's going to announce what's going to happen to his business interests, which is a whole other topic in this case. Speaking of sui generis, with regard to the various business interests, the large sums of money that we're talking about, how that's going to be handled, not just in the short term, but over the longer term, remains very much to be seen. I suspect it will be a chronic issue.
Is this Donald Trump's Republican Party now? He obviously has Congress, to work with. But, you know, there's the Tea Party element. There's the more establishment Republican element. And Trump himself has, had shown a willingness to buck Republican orthodoxy in the past. Is he going to be able to marshal the Republican Party like past Republican presidents have been able to?
But we have a two-party system, and we're not going to have a three-party or a four-party or a five-party system simply because we put together our coalitions before elections. You know, we have in every, almost every state race, you have a single-member district. It's only one person is going to hold that seat, and whoever gets the most votes wins. So if you have a three-way race, all of the force is trying to get it down to two candidates. So the Republican Party is here to stay. The Democrat Party is here to stay. But the coalitions that support them, that make them up, shift over time. In Massachusetts, in the 1950s, the liberal party in Massachusetts was the Republican Party. The conservative party, the Catholic party, was the Democratic Party. So is he the leader of the party? Well, yeah, of course. He's the president of the United States. He's a Republican. He has a Republican House and a Republican Senate. But what does that mean for the party going forward? There is no national Republican Party. There is no national Democratic Party. There are 50 state Republican parties. There are 50 state Democratic parties. And they get together every 4 years and nominate a candidate. So if we're looking for coherence in a policy message from either party, we're just looking in the wrong country. This is a heck of a lot more fun than knowing what the parties are going to stand for.
I can't resist. Well, there's two things I would comment on. The Tea Party, which I think has been a terrific force in American politics in recent years, seems to me, even the phrase Tea Party, I believe we heard it unbelievably less in 2016 and even 2015 mm-hmm. than we did for the several years previous, for various reasons which we don't have time to go into. But since you ask about parties, I would argue that the more interesting party right now to look at, I realize it's not the basis of this conversation, is the Democratic Party. What it will be like after Hillary, what it's going to be, what role Bernie Sanders is going to play or Elizabeth Warren is going to play, or is it really going to swing to the left? Is it going to remain the centrist party that it has been for a fair amount of time in recent years? There is no obvious leader of the day, you know, as David just said, Trump is the obvious, whatever one may think of him, the leader of the Republican Party. There is no obvious equivalent on the Democratic side. And in terms of party politics, that to me will be at least as interesting, if not more so, over the next 4 years as the Republican Party.
One of the great characteristics of our American political system is that it is highly responsive to voters. One of the things that struck me in working in the White House and going to Capitol Hill was that pleading with people that the president really needs you on this carried practically no weight whatsoever.
The president doesn't vote in their district.
The president would get a nice smile and thank you very much. What moves people, what gets them to do what you would like them to do, is demonstrating to them that what it is you want them to do is going to benefit their constituents. They need to be able to go home and explain to people why they voted the way they did, why they supported this or why they supported that. And saying that the leader of my party or the President of the United States or the Speaker of the House asked me to do this is not viewed as a very acceptable answer. So to get people to move, you have to persuade them that the content of the policy that you are asking them to support is in fact going to benefit their constituents, and to give them evidence to help them make the argument that I'm doing this because I'm thinking about you and I am there representing you. And I think this is more true today than it may well have been in the past, and I see nothing that is going to cause it to reverse direction. We've become an incredibly responsive. People spend way more time at home, have way more interactions with their constituents. They don't live in D.C. They raise their own money when they go out to run. They do not view themselves as beholden to a political party. Donald Trump does not view himself as beholden to the Republican Party for his election. He won the Republican Party nomination, but he actually made quite clear in the first debate that he was not obligated to support whoever the Republican Party nominee was unless he felt the process had been fair. And I will make up my mind as we go along whether or not I think the process is fair, because I think he believed, hold it, I've been a Democrat most of my life, I've supported Democratic candidates, maybe this party is not going to welcome me or embrace me, and therefore I'm going to keep my distance.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's discussion. Thank you all so much, Professor Roger Porter, Senior Lecturer David King, and of course the Lecturer Barbara Kellerman. Thank you so much for coming on PolicyCast today.
Thank you.
Thanks,
good
Matt.
Good discussion.
Yeah.
Special thanks once again for HKS Magazine's editor, Robert O'Neill, for his instrumental role in making this series of roundtables happen. You can find excerpts from this interview and others in the upcoming winter issue. You can also find all of our episodes of PolicyCast on Medium, so check it out at hkspolicycast.org. HKS PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader. Natalie Montaner is our guest wrangler, Sarah Abrams, our sage advisor, and Becky Wickel, our deft digital deliberator. Send us your comments and questions to policycast@hks.harvard.edu or on Twitter @policycast. See you next week.